We shall turn now to consider together for a little words that are found in the epistle of James, James chapter 1, and we may read some few verses just now. Verse 13, James chapter 1, reading from verse 13. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. And sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Do not err, my beloved brethren. Every good and every perfect gift is from above, and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning, and so on. May the Lord bless the reading, this short reading from this chapter. We have been considering the instruction that James was giving to these scattered saints who were faced with tribulation and difficulties, and they were in danger of misinterpreting God's providential dealings with them. And so James brings before them the facts, as far as God is concerned, that they need to be patient because there is a purpose in their providences, the trial of their faith, which is very precious, is in reality the purpose of God in their providences. God is trying and testing their faith, and then we also noted he is testing and trying their love for him. Do they love him in spite of how little they understand his dealings with him? Have they confidence in him? Can they rely upon him that he intends to give a crown of life to those who persevere and those who prove that they love God in the face of trials and troubles? And James comes now to deal with a problem that he obviously perceived to be among these believers. They are his brethren. He's writing to them with compassion, with care, with brotherly affection. He's not seeking to criticize them or find fault with them. He's trying to guide them in the right direction, and he is endeavoring to influence their minds so that they will appreciate what God is doing with them and for them, and that they will benefit from it. And the words that we would endeavor to center our thoughts around presently are those words in verse 16. Do not err, my beloved brethren. Do not err, my beloved brethren. And you will see right away that James is addressing brethren, and it is possible that in their present circumstances they might adopt erroneous notions and opinions, and that that would result in erroneous and sinful actions. Do not err, or as the expression means, it is translated in other parts, be not deceived. That's really what he means. Be not deceived, my beloved brethren. And what James is talking about is the mind wandering off in a dangerous direction and departing from God, and then not benefiting from what God has purposed and what he is doing with them. Do not err. Now, or do not be deceived. And you know yourself that the great deceiver is Satan, and he is ever working, therefore, to deceive, as we go back to the very beginning, to his activities in the garden. He deceived Eve, led her astray by giving her or impressing upon her mind the notion that God was withholding from her that which was actually good, that God was not as good toward Adam and Eve as they might have imagined. If God was forbidding them to eat of a certain tree, and the tree was good, well then God was forbidding them that which was good. And Satan, you see, will come again and again, and he will come with the same question. Hath God said? Is God really forbidding you? Is God really commanding you? Are you sure you're interpreting what God has said correctly? This is the danger that James has in mind. Satan coming to those who are the children of God, and in these critical times that they are experiencing, they begin then to sin against God because they are deceived and they are going astray and their minds are straying in the wrong direction. And the first danger that James, I believe, identifies is this, the danger of falsely accusing God. You see what James says, verse 13, let no man say. And obviously James, you see, was aware that some were at least thinking this way, well, God is sovereign. God is absolutely in control of everything. So if God is in control of everything, why are things so bad? You hear the argument, you hear the reasoning of those who say they don't believe the Bible and they don't believe what it teaches, and they will accuse God of being the author of sin in the beginning, because they will say, well, if God is all power, couldn't he have prevented Adam from sinning? And if God has the power to do that, well, why did he not do it? Why did he allow Adam to sin? And then they will trace back, you see, in their supposedly logical thinking, they go back to God. Well, since God could have prevented it, he didn't do it. Well, really, he's responsible for sin. He's responsible for permitting sin to come into the world. And that is the reasoning that even today, some of the Lord's people are responsible for and guilty of. They will reason in their minds the same way. Here's my providences, and here are the difficulties. Here are the problems. Here are all the opposing difficulties that are troubling me and making me feel bad and making me act even sinfully. Well, if God knows this is the effect they would have upon me, why does he send them to me? And the reasoning is sinful, but it is always to go back to accuse God, going back to the beginning. God created man in his own image. And one of the great blessings, the great gifts that God gave to man originally, was his free will. Now, you just imagine how different it would be if God created Adam as a slave with no will of his own, or as a robot that he just has to do what God orders him to do. He's a kind of puppet. God pulls the strings and he has to act. Well, you see, God blessed Adam with a free will. But he also gave him the faculty of conscience. And he gave him the faculty of reason. He gave him an intellect so that he could think. And he had a conscience to tell him what was right and what was wrong, so that he could make the right decision. And he would act correctly. He would not disobey, because his conscience would convict him, and his conscience would reveal to him, this is the right decision to take. This is the right way to go. But Adam, blessed with that great blessing of a free will, he used it to disobey God. He chose willingly himself to go astray from God, to rebel against God. And this is what we're going to see here, that James deals with. The good gifts that come from the hand of God are taken by men, and they are abused or they are misused to dishonor God. And yet, in the midst of it, men will complain against God. But James says, do not err. Make sure you do not fall into error, and you do not end up accusing God of tempting you into sin, because he has sent you certain circumstances, he has ordered to you certain difficulties, and you then begin to accuse God that if God had acted differently or thought differently or sent you a different set of circumstances, well, then you wouldn't be tempted to sin, as James obviously believes some of them had done. But then again, in connection with this, James is warning against erroneous thinking regarding the origin of sin itself. You see, those who would accuse God would be laying the blame on him, not recognizing the real source, where the seed of sin is sown, where it begins. What does James say? Every man is tempted. Every man is tempted. Not some, not those who are easily tempted, but every man is tempted. When a man falls into temptation, or a woman, this is how James says it happens. He says he is tempted when he is drawn away. When he is drawn away of his own lust, or his own, as we said last week, self-centered desires. And that is a question that every one of us, at every stage in our own daily lives, should be asking. It will be decisive again and again on many occasions. This that I'm about to do, this action I'm about to take, these words I'm about to speak, what motivates me? Is it the honor and the glory of God solely, or is it self-interest? Even my prayers, when I bring my petitions to God, what is behind them? Is it self-interest, or is it that God would be honored? And you see, James is saying, do not err, my brethren. Do not pretend that you have been tempted into sin by a force outside of yourself, and blame either God or Satan as though you are completely innocent. What James is saying is this, that lust, self-interest, self-desires, self-ambition, when it hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin. So sin comes from within, doesn't come from without. It comes from within. And that is something that we are very reluctant sometimes to accept. We will look to blame some outside force. We will blame Satan, and if on occasions we will even blame God and not acknowledge. It's my responsibility. It's I who sinned. It was my desires that led me into sin. It was not God's desires, and it was not a desire to please him or glorify him that led me into sin. It was my own self-centered interests that led me into sinning. And James is saying here, sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Sin, once committed, it expands, it grows, it develops. Commit one sin, and then another is needed to cover it up, and then more sins are needed or committed in order to cover up what has previously been done. You see this in the experience of the psalmist David. He neglects his duty, and then when he's neglecting his duty, he's tempted into sin. And then when he commits adultery with another man's wife, his conscience undoubtedly troubled him sufficiently that he recognizes he has a predicament on his hands. So then he sends the husband, the innocent husband, off to the front line of the battle and eventually has him killed, in reality murdered, and so on. And sin was adding to sin. And that's why James says, do not err, my beloved brethren. Sin is dangerous. Sin is extremely dangerous. And sin doesn't stop innocently. Sin develops. Sin, when it is finished, keeps making progress. Children learn that at an early stage in life. They tell one little lie, and then they have to tell another one to cover it up, and on it goes. And once they've told the first lie, the second one is easier to tell, and so on. Because sin, when it is finished, it keeps progressing, and it keeps developing. When it is finished, it bringeth forth death. So James is saying, brethren, be not deceived. Sin is dangerous. And a fall into sin is really dangerous. But then he moves from the negative to the positive. And here in verse 17, it's connected with what he has previously been saying. Do not err, my beloved brethren. Do not err over what I've already told you. But now, do not err regarding God himself. Don't accuse him of being the author of sin, but recognize he's the very opposite of that. Do not err in your understanding of who God is and what God does and what God purposes even in your circumstances. Do not err. Now you go back in the chapter to the advice offered by James for those who lack wisdom, verse 5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God. And then he gives us insight into who God is and the character of God. Let him ask of God that giveth to all men liberally, and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. Why is this? Because God is a giving God. God is a giving God. He gives wisdom, and he gives it liberally, and he upbraideth not. God is a liberal giver. And James is now directing the minds of those to whom he writes, to this God and his giving. He doesn't send circumstances to his people, his children, to make them sin. That's impossible, because that would be against the very nature and the very character of God. God doesn't do evil. God always does good. God never sends evil to his people. He always sends what is good for them. and therefore they are not to err in their interpreting of God's dealings with them. And what does James say? Verse 17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. Every good and every perfect gift. Now, of course, since these gifts come from above, they come from God, they must be perfect. God would never give anything that is not perfect. And everything that these believers were experiencing, James says it actually has its source in heaven. And it is God's gift, and it is God's gift from above to those who cannot purchase it, who cannot procure it. You remember what Paul tells Timothy, we came into this world with nothing. Every one of us, we came into this world with nothing. Or you might say, well, we had parents who cared for us and fed us and so on. But the reality is, we came into this world personally owning nothing, so that everything had to be provided for us from the moment we began to live in this world. Everything had to be provided for us. Now, our parents couldn't even provide for us if God didn't provide for them. They must pray, give us this day our daily bread in order to feed their offspring. And the fact is that, you see, the children of God are to recognize this. I am a dependent creature. I have nothing of myself, absolutely nothing. I came into the world, I didn't bring riches with me. I came into the world, I didn't bring a credible life with me. I came into the world and all I brought with me was my sinful nature. But James says, every good and every perfect gift, everything that a man or a woman or a young person therefore possesses, let it be as little as can be. It is the gift from God. What does Paul say? What does he say to Timothy? Having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. For we brought nothing into this world. We didn't bring our food with us. We didn't bring our raiment with us. But who provided it? It was God who provided it. And we can take nothing of it with us when we leave this world, having food and raiment. Therewith let us be content. Now, how many of us here, we all have a lot more than merely food and raiment? You think of all that you have and that I have beyond food and raiment. It's as though we are to be content with the necessities. Food and raiment, those are the necessities. Having the necessities, therewith let us be content. But every one of us, the truth is, we do have more than the basic mere necessities. What does that mean? Everything beyond the necessities is God's gift in abundance. Every good and every perfect gift cometh from above. Now, what does that mean, every good gift, every perfect gift? Well, it is perfect, whatever it is, whatever its nature, it has to be seen as being perfect because it comes from God. The God who provides it is all wise. The God who provides it is all-knowing. And therefore, whatever he sends from above, is perfectly suited to the situation. Perfectly suited for the recipient. God doesn't make any mistakes. God doesn't overlook anything. And you think of it, you ask yourself, maybe you're faced with some problem, some difficulty. Think to yourself, well, why is God sending me this? Why today is God facing me with this? I would rather have some other circumstances. I would rather be in another position. But James says, do not err, beloved brethren. Everything that God sends is perfect. Perfect. Now you know what perfect means. There can be no flaw, no mistake, no error. It's perfect. God does everything in perfection. And you and I, sometimes we are struggling to see any good in some of our providences. But if we are not to err, we have to acknowledge this. What God is sending is perfect. Perfect for me, perfect in His purpose. It is perfect for my edification. It is perfect for my growth and grace. God knows what He's doing. But then it is perfect, and it is also good. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, comes from God's hand as perfect. It comes to us as good. Because it is perfect from God, it is meant for our good. And we should be then looking at everything in our providence. Well, it has come from God. Therefore, it is perfect as far as God's concerned. It's perfectly suitable to the situation that I'm in. Perfectly suitable to the circumstances that I meet with. And it is intended for my good. Even if I can't see that good. Even if I am unable to discern it presently, it is for my good. Because God intends not to harm me, but He intends my good. That chapter that we read from 2 Corinthians, the experience of the Apostle Paul, he is speaking of God's unique dealings with him that would cause men, if they knew, well, this is the experience of Paul. He's way beyond every one of us spiritually. There are none that we know of that would have such an elevated view and experience with God as this apostle. And what does Paul say? If I were to start and talk about it, I'd be acting foolishly. But he does know that what God has done with him and for him is good, spiritually good. But he also learns something else. And in verse 7 of 2 Corinthians 12, we read these words, and lest. How good it is that God knows what He knows. And how good it is that those words are there, and lest. What is Paul concerned about? And lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of revelations. Paul is saying, well, I've been favored greatly, uniquely. I've been favored by God to have this high spiritual experience. Now he said, I might begin to think, well, I'm specially favored. I am specially favored by God to be favored by men. Now he says, lest I should be exalted and become proud and haughty and high-minded. there was given to me. What is James talking about? Every good and every perfect gift. Here's Paul's gift. Now, it was a great gift to be carried into the third heavens. But then you see God in his wisdom balances things out. And he knew about Paul, and Paul is learning. God obviously knows something about me that I don't know, just like Simon Peter. There was given to me a thorn in the flesh, the messenger of Satan to buffet me. Well, Satan's buffetings are mighty sore and they're mighty painful. And Paul is saying here, the messenger of Satan came to buffet me, and he was whispering into my ear every kind of deceitful thought, an idea, a notion of God. And I was being buffeted with these thoughts that were passing through my mind. I was endeavoring to see God's hand in my providences. I was endeavoring to learn the purpose of God. But there was a messenger of Satan straight from hell, and he was coming with his lies and his deceit to whisper into my ear, to cause me to go astray from God. The thorn in the flesh, it was given to me. In other words, what Paul is acknowledging is this, this thorn in the flesh, it's not accidental. It's a gift. It is given to me. There in the Psalm 55, you have the psalmist directed by the Spirit of God to say, write, cast thy burden upon the Lord, for he shall sustain thee. Now that word burden is a very interesting word. It means that which is assigned to someone. It is that which they have to fulfill, that which they bear and carry as a responsibility. But it is a word that is sometimes translated gift. And therefore, what the psalmist is acknowledging is this. What I, in my weakness, might feel to be a heavy burden is actually a gift from God. It has a purpose behind it. And sometimes, I've said before, sometimes the Lord has to slow us down. He has to make us appreciative of our weakness. You see the donkey, and he's out there, or the ass, and he can run around freely where he wants to go, do as he likes, free and easy. But then when he has a burden placed upon his back, he slows down. When he's carrying a burden, it slows him down. His pace is different. And sometimes the Lord has a kind purpose in sending trials and burdens. And instead of complaining about them, we should be recognizing God is doing something important. God has sent me this burden for a reason. Just as Paul learned here, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh. Maybe Paul thought, well, I wonder why no one else has got this thorn in the flesh. Why me? After all, I'm an apostle to the Gentiles. I'm working, I'm laboring, I'm doing the work of God. The last thing I need is a thorn in the flesh. What was God thinking? It's exactly because, Paul, you are such a successful missionary, and it is because you're taking the gospel to the Gentiles, and it is because you are so useful that I've sent you this thorn in the flesh to keep you useful. That's what Paul is coming to realize. And he says here, I besought the Lord three times that it might depart from me. Now that would indicate that Paul was very earnest and he was clearly of a mind. If only I could be rid of this thorn in the flesh, if God would withdraw it, if God would take it back. And yet, it was God's gift. Every good and every perfect gift cometh from above. And Paul has to recognize, while I can't understand it, while I am mystified by it, God has sent it. And then God says, my grace is sufficient for thee, because my strength is made perfect in weakness. And obviously, God had a purpose. Paul was thinking, well, this thorn in the flesh is weakening me. And God is of a mind, that's exactly what I intend, Paul. And then he goes on to say, most gladly, therefore, will I glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ might rest upon me. And then notice the change of tone. Therefore, I take pleasure. I was praying for God to take away the thorn in the flesh. I was praying earnestly, even 3 times I prayed, remove this messenger of Satan who's buffeting me all the time. I don't get any pleasure, this thorn in the flesh, it's not pleasurable at all. Very unpleasant. Doesn't give me any pleasure, it's a pain. Now he says, I take pleasure in infirmities. I take pleasure now in reproaches. I take pleasure in necessities. I take pleasure in persecutions, even in distresses. What a change. And what has made the change? When Paul acknowledges whatever it is that God sends, he sends grace with it. Whatever he sends, if he sends a thorn in the flesh, he sends grace alongside of it. He sends grace with it. And so often we see the thorn in the flesh, we don't see the grace. Isn't that correct? And that's why we complain, that's why we become disturbed and distressed. Paul comes to say, I now take pleasure in the things, the very thing I wanted God to remove, I see it totally differently now. And now I take pleasure in it. Why would I take pleasure? Is it because it's less painful? Is it because it doesn't trouble me anymore? No, it's because now I understand the purpose of God behind it. And when James is writing here to these believers, he is telling them they must not err. Do not be deceived. Do not let the devil deceive you into misunderstanding what God is doing. Because every good and every perfect gift is from above and cometh down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. What's Paul saying about the character of God and the being of God? He doesn't change. There is no variableness, not even the slightest variableness in God. He doesn't change, never changes, impossible for him to change. And so, if he is a giving God, and he gives liberally, he always gives liberally. It's in his very nature to give liberally. He gives because he loves his people. Nothing can separate them from the love of God. Not even the adverse circumstances they meet with, they cannot separate them from the love of God, because God is giving what is good. The psalmist tells us in Psalm 84 that God will not withhold any good thing. He will not withhold any good thing from the man that walketh uprightly. And so he doesn't leave it to you and I to decide what the good thing would be. We might be thinking, well, if that happened to me, that would be the worst thing possible. If I was faced with that situation, I don't know how I would cope with it. That's how we would be thinking. And we would be thinking many, many times, I just hope God doesn't send me this or send me that. I hope he withholds this and withholds that from me. But you see, if it's good for us, God can't withhold it. Because you see, God has a good nature. And God naturally gives what is good. At a certain time of the year, you will see people, I don't know whether they do it so much here, but back in UK, it's everywhere. People decorating their houses with their Christmas trees. And they get an imitation tree, or they cut one down, and they decorate it all up with lights and gifts and bubbles. But the thing is, they only get from the tree what they give it. They lay out their gifts around it, and they hang up their bubbles and their little gifts, and the children come and take them off and whatever. How different when you go to the orchard to an apple tree. You don't go and hang apples on the tree before you take them off. They're already there. Why? Because the tree is giving out of itself. That's in its nature. It produces apples. It gives the gifts of apples out of itself. And that's what God does. Every good and every perfect gift comes from God, who gives out of himself. Now, if we can understand that, James says, my beloved brethren, do not err. Do not think hard thoughts of God. Do not begin to question the wisdom of God or the goodness of God. Do not question what God is doing. Every good and every perfect gift cometh down unto the undeserving. It cometh down, and it cometh from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He doesn't change. He will always be good. He will always be doing good. He will always purpose good. And therefore, day by day, our attitude should be the same. Our knowledge of God should continue consistent. Maybe even if we look back over this day, over the days of this week, we might be wondering to ourselves, what is the purpose in this strange providence? What is God saying to me in these circumstances? What is God intending? Well, we have to approach what God gives. And when God gives anything, it has to be a gift. And when God gives every gift, it's good, it's perfect. It's perfect coming from God, and it is good for me. I have nothing to complain about. I have nothing to lament over. It is intended for my good. And just like the Apostle Paul, what does he now say? Instead of praying, remove this thorn in the flesh, he's now rejoicing. God has not left me to myself. God knows my danger, that I just might become puffed up. And you see how Paul in this chapter that we were looking at, 2 Corinthians, going back to it, Paul says, lest I should be exalted above measure. God had exalted him, but he might become exalted in his own mind, and twice he says it, lest I should be exalted above measure. Then at the end of the verse, lest I should be exalted above measure. Twice he says it, he repeats it. And yet, you go back to Acts chapter 20, and you have the apostle telling the elders in Ephesus how he served God consistently among them. Verse 19 of Acts 20, serving the Lord, he was with them in all seasons, serving the Lord with all humility of mind, with many tears and temptations. Notice that, with all humility of mind. And we would be thinking, well, if there was any humble man around, it was Paul. Serving the Lord with humility of mind. And yet Paul says, God knows things about me that I don't know about myself. God knows dangers that Satan would try to ensnare me in. And therefore he knows how to deal with it. And this is what James is saying to these brethren. Brethren, do not err. Do not err when you consider God's dealings with you. Consider them well. Consider them as profitable and as beneficial to you, because they are sent from God, who loves his children, and he only seeks their good as any father would. He's the Father of lights, with whom there is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. We shall leave it there. May the Lord bless his word.